See, I think it's quite possible that the 1960s represented the last burst of the human being before he was extinguished. And that this is the beginning of the rest of the future now, that from now on there'll simply be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing. And there'll be nobody left almost to remind them that there once was a species called a human being, with feelings and thoughts, and that history and memory are right now being erased, and soon nobody will really remember that life existed on the planet.
Nou ja, ik denk ook voor land helemaal niet gekend.
Tegen die Russen?
De Russen,
ja. Genauer gesagt, haben wir nicht gegen die Russen gekämpft, sondern gegen den Bolschewismus.
Naja,
der Russe ist
genau der gleiche wie
stalinistischer Bolschewismus und haben versucht, unser Land davor zu schützen und vor allen Dingen vielleicht ganz Europa. Wenn wir den Bolschewismus nicht aufgehalten hätten, dann wäre er auch über ihr Land gekommen und vielleicht nach Frankreich und so weiter.
Ja, wir sind keine Halbküste.
Ja, genau.
Der Russe, hatten alles vor.
Wir hatten, weil ja, wir mussten auch gegen den Amerikaner kämpfen, weil der dann gelandet ist. In Frankreich und in Italien und in Afrika und so weiter, haben wir am Schluss gegen den Russen, gegen zum Teil zwölffache Übermacht gekämpft. Und immer mit der Hoffnung, ihn noch von den Reichsgrenzen fernzuhalten, zum Schutz unserer Bevölkerung. Er hat ja nicht die Genfer Konvention unterzeichnet und hat also vom Kriegsvölkerrecht, musste er gar nicht Gebrauch machen, das hat er auch gezeigt. Und hat entsprechend unsere Bevölkerung aufgehetzt, natürlich durch die sowjetische Propaganda, die bolschewistische, massakriert und zum Teil ganz misshandelt. Hauptsächlich die Frauen. Und das haben wir versucht, bis zuletzt zu verhindern. Das ist uns nicht gelungen, aber wir haben es versucht.
Deutschen Soldaten nie passiert. Vielleicht, aber streng verboten.
Ich meine,
die Vergewaltigung von Frauen.
Aufschreitung.
Das haben da die Russen gemacht. Das
haben Deutsche nicht gemacht, meine ich.
Deutsche
Nein.
nicht.
Nein, das
wird
zwar immer behauptet.
Erwischt wurde, der wurde
das wird behauptet, Schluss. Das hat die deutsche Wehrmacht nicht gemacht.
Das war nicht erlaubt. Also wer erwischt wurde, wurde sofort erschossen oder in die Scharfkompanie gesteckt.
Aber es hat doch auch Unangenehmheiten gegeben zwischen der Wehrmacht und der Bevölkerung.
Sehr wurscht.
In Holland.
Welche denn?
In
Pützeln, mein Dorf, wo
ja,
ich geboren bin.
Was ist da passiert?
Da hat die Wehrmacht das ganze Dorf umriegelt und die männliche Bevölkerung zum Arbeitseinsatz ins Reich deportiert.
Ja.
Und von den über 600 abgeführten Männern sind nur 49 zurückgekommen.
Haben Sie da Beweise?
Ja, die Männer sind nie wiedergekommen. Mein Großonkel waren dabei, die sind dabei umgekommen.
Und das hat die Wehrmacht gemacht? Das glaube ich nicht. Die Was? Wehrmacht hat mit diesen Arbeitseinsatz Leute zu verhaften. Das war vielleicht Polizeitruppe.
Kurz außen vor dem Dorf wurde ein Attentat auf ein deutsches Auto verübt. Und es sind zwei, aber es war nicht sicher, dass
da
Putzende daran beteiligt waren.
Das war der Auslöser. Es
hat immer eine Ursache, wenn solche Reaktionen überreagieren.
Aber das war nicht gemäß dem Kriegsrecht.
Ja.
Aber das, was die Attentäter, wo das Auto von Partisanen oder von Nichtkombattanten vernichtet wurde oder getötet war, das war auch nicht nach dem Kriegsrecht. Oder waren es holländische Soldaten?
Nee, es waren Widerstandskämpfer.
Sehen Sie, da haben wir schon. Partisanen, sagt man im Osten.
Das war
die Ursache. Die Reaktion auf dieses Vorkommen, dass ein Fahrzeug vernichtet wurde durch Partisanen.
Aber das allererste Verbrechen war doch, dass die Niederlande mit Krieg überrollt worden waren. Jetzt
richtig.
Ist begonnen.
Ja, das ist richtig.
Einmarschiert
ohne zu fragen, ob wir das dürfen. Ob das die Wehrmacht darf. Erst hätte fragen müssen, dürfen wir durch Holland durchmarschieren.
Vielleicht Kriegserklärung abgeben.
Ja, da hätte aber niemand gesagt, ihr könnt das. Im Krieg herrschen andere Gesetze.
I grew up just as every other American, looking back at World War II, of which my father was a veteran, in fact, of the Normandy invasion, D-Day plus two. I look back on with other Americans with great pride at what Americans were able to do and to liberate Europe and so on. However, I don't feel the same way about that war anymore, and I'm convinced that my father was still living. that he would also greatly question what he had actually participated in. Again, the Soviet Union was manipulating the American war effort and the British war effort as well in order to defeat Hitler, to supplant him with Stalin. And this is exactly what happened. The logic of the map is what tells us that what I'm saying has credence, because when you look at that post-war map, what happened? There is a devastated Germany, and in that vacuum, there is a new, thriving, powerful U.S. supplied Soviet Empire in its place.
World War II was the crossroads of human history. It was a battle of two opposing ideologies, philosophies, and worldviews. It was a battle between nationalism and globalism. It was a war between Germany and the Jewish powers who control the Allied governments and their media. Adolf Hitler and his allies fought to preserve the concept of nationalism, not just for Germans, but for all peoples the world over. The world that we are living in today is the world of the victors of that war. This is the world of globalism, capitalism, and communism. The outcome of World War II decided the fate of our civilization. Countries did not lose the Second World War, but humanity as a whole. Over 60 million people died in the most horrific war in human history. After Germany's defeat, Europe was placed back again under the heel of the bankers, where it remains to this day. The old debt payments originating from the post-Treaty of Versailles was reinstituted in 1948 and was not paid off until 2010. Germany is now totally controlled by the Rothschild, Goldman Sachs, and the Federal Reserve. These same forces of international Uri are the very same about which Adolf Hitler tried to forewarn the German people. All of Germany's gold reserves are now held in the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Today, the German people find themselves in the same state of economic servitude which Hitler tried to correct. Germany is still paying off war reparations for World War II. On the 23rd of May 1949, the Western Allies ratified a new German constitution known as the Basic Law, Grundgesetz. 2 days prior, a secret state treaty, Geheimer Staatsvertrag, was also signed. This granted complete Allied control over education and all licensed media, press, radio, television, and publishing houses, until the year 2099. Germany is still an occupied land, with over 100,000 foreign troops stationed on her soil, and the Jews have never made peace with her. No peace treaty has been concluded with any of the Allied powers. Free speech and freedom of thought is gone, not only in Germany, but in most parts of Europe. The Jew Martin Schulz, president of the European Parliament, explained, "The new Germany exists only in order to ensure the existence of the State of Israel and the Jewish people." There you have World War II in one quote. That was what the war was all about, breaking down Germany and making her a milking cow to the bankers again. The globalist United Nations began with the London Declaration of 12th of June 1941. The name United Nations was coined by Franklin Roosevelt and was used during the Declaration by United Nations of January 1942. On June 26, 1945, the founding charter for the United Nations was signed. At the founding San Francisco conference that established the United Nations, the U.S. official serving as Secretary General was the communist agent Alger Hiss, who was exposed as a Soviet spy in 1948. The UN replaced the globalist League of Nations as the foundation of the globalist New World Order. The UN was put up based upon Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, but this time the whole world would slowly be turned into the new Soviet Union. The New World Government would now be headquartered in New York on 18 acres of prime real estate donated by the Rockefeller family. This was the final nail in the coffin. International communism had officially won the war. The globalist NATO and EU also came as a consequence from the war as stepping stones to a future world government. The United Nations, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, the Gorbachev Foundation, and the Club of Rome, and many other shadowy fifth column organizations now work together to destabilize the sovereign nations to create a communist world order. Communism would spread from the Soviet Union with the help of communist Jews. Even in China, Soviet Jews were at work helping Mao Zedong, high up in the political department of the Red Army in China, were W.N. Levitchev and J.B. Gamarnik. By progressive social movements in the name of helping people, communism killed over 60 million in the Soviet Union, 70 million in the People's Republic of China, 3 million in Korea, 2 million in Cambodia, 1.7 million in Africa, 1.6 million in Vietnam, 1.6 million in Poland, 1.5 million in Afghanistan, 1.2 million in Tito's Yugoslavia, 1 million elsewhere in Eastern Europe, 1 million in Ethiopia, 400,000 in Romania, 200,000 in Bulgaria, 150,000 in Latin America, 100,000 in Mongolia, 100,000 in Albania, 73,000 in Cuba, 70,000 in the German Democratic Republic, 65,000 in Czechoslovakia, 27,000 in Hungary, 10,000 by communist parties not in power and the international communist movement. Yet, no movies, no Holocaust reparations, no memorials for these victims. The communist flag is not banned, and communist policies are still normalized, and Marxism is even taught as standard in our schools. Western civilization that literally took thousands of years to develop with the help of the Romans laying the foundation was destroyed in less than two centuries. All healthy societal norms have been broken down. Healthy nationalism has been replaced with a culture of guilt, ethnomasochism, self-hatred, apathy, degeneracy, and pathological altruism. Traditionalism is labeled sick and outdated. Views on parenting have changed significantly. Just 50 years ago, a person in Europe was first considered to be a grown-up after they had created a strong family. Thanks to the culture Marxist brainwashing, Europeans don't anymore believe their position in society will be improved by having offspring. Consequently, they instead focus on materialist matters to fill up their void of unfulfillment. As Europeans, we are no longer defined by our virtues or intellects. We do not longer exist as people with common history, heritage, or values. We have been reduced into rootless, cultureless, genderless, alienated, infertile, over-medicated, and under-educated, taxed, and debt slaves. We are no longer people defined by our qualities or intellects. We have become soulless machines, taxpayers, and human resources. We are defined solely by our net worth and our ability to consume crap that we don't even need. People no longer talk with each other on the streets. We have forgotten everything that meant something to our ancestors. We have lost touch with both our past and our present, and we live in some imaginary fantasy world where happiness is just around the corner, but never really is found. This is the world of blind equality, where all sexes, races, cultures, ethnicities are the same in one homogeneous, rootless gray goop. Each individual is the same. Without roots, identities, or cultures, we will be exploited by the tyrannical global elite. Our identities are installed into us by the state instead of our parents. Our people are stripped of a past to defend in our future. The European spirit that was rooted in vital institutions such as family, farm, folk, and the community has been totally wiped out. We are no longer defined by common cultures, traditions, bloodlines, and set of everlasting values. We are not united in our desire to protect our culture and way of life. This is our modern world. This is the world of consumerism, nihilism, hedonism, and empty materialism. The world of uninspiring, generic, modern, abstract art and architecture. The destruction of Western civilization is applauded as something progressive and tolerant. We now live in the world of cheap Chinese imports for the rich and eternal wage slavery for the poor. This is the world of globalism, installed by the victors of the Second World War, by the ideology of international communism. This was exactly what the National Socialists during World War II tried to warn humanity of. Our governments are acting on behalf of influential lobbyists, NGOs, and globalist organizations, which in turn work for a global elite. The essential driving force and cohesive core of this global elite consists of Jews, who see the ethnic transformation of former white homogeneous Western countries as beneficial for ethnically Jewish minority interests. Because of historical, religious, and mere tactical reasons, many Jews view the white race as their greatest enemy in the fight for power and influence. It is critical to realize that these powers do not have our well-being in mind. In their eyes, we are simply seen as their cattle. In a multicultural society with other more visible and on the surface more problematic minority groups, Jews appear as a seemingly invisible minority and not as an outside hostile social category. In this way, the Jews can safely continue to exercise their power by pushing their specific ethnic group interests at the expense of the indigenous populations.
All the Jewish organizations got on board with the idea that we have to import other peoples. We have to change the demographic profile of these societies so that they will not be homogeneous anymore, that they will not be able to gang up against the Jews. So I think those are the two big reasons. One is to push aside previous elites to make room for a Jewish elite, but also to the fear and real hatred that the Jews have had historically towards white Christian societies.
The most powerful globalist currently is the Hungarian Jew George Soros. He is known for his intense hatred for white people and having his long tentacles in basically everything that weakens Western civilization, everything that divides and inflames minorities with hatred for white Europeans. Soros' non-governmental organizations have engineered the migrant crisis, knowing full well that there will inevitably be a major culture clash. Soros funds the Divide and Conquer terror organization Black Lives Matter that encourages violence against whites. Soros funds the radical feminist organization FEMIN, who pits white women against their own men, teach them to hate their fathers and despise their brothers through relentless bashing of the hetero white male. FEMIN and other feminist organizations, while marching around bare-breasted, advocate for radical Islam, a religion that cuts off the clitorises of little girls and requires the women to be covered up from head to toe. Not only Germany and Europe lost the Second World War, but even the nations in the Middle East, as the Zionists and neocons invented the fictitious War on Terror after the 9/11 attacks to destabilize any nation that would try to emulate the economic success of National Socialist Germany and go against the globalists.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
What is Israel's role in this, Ken O'Keefe?
Well, the Greater Israel Project is all about destabilizing surrounding nations, ultimately in pursuit of this dream of Greater Israel from the Euphrates down to the Nile, all the way over to the Eastern Mediterranean. This is the dream of these psychopaths, and so destabilizing governments, creating sectarian strife is all part of that menu and all part of the design to create Greater Israel. So that goes it's self-evident. But I have to go back to what this gentleman is saying in Washington, D.C. about America not wanting to get involved, or Obama not getting involved. What are you talking about? We have been arming people directly who are al-Qaeda. Al-Nusra Front is al-Qaeda. These people are psychopaths to the worst order. They're conducting suicide attacks. They're gassing people. We know Carla Del Ponte said in May that it was the so-called rebels in Syria that were using sarin gas, not the Bashar al-Assad regime. No, it was not. We know that the United States president is arming people who are on the U.S. terrorist list. He should be convicted of aiding and abetting, giving material support to a terrorist organization. But then again, you know what? We, the West, the United States in particular, Israel and Britain, are the biggest terrorists on the planet. So our little junior partners in al-Qaeda, which is nothing more than a CIA database, thus the name al-Qaeda, this is nothing more than a group of terrorists working together, each playing one different role, but all of them working together for the same goal, which is to maintain this hideous and sick and twisted, unjust world that we have, which is a perpetual state of war. Always one illusion, one boogeyman after another. But the fact is, Obama is nothing more than a puppet war criminal, just like his predecessor and every other U.S. president before him. So please don't tell people out there that the U.S. is not involved. It's directly involved, and it is arming people who are absolute psychopaths. That is what we discussed earlier, the Greater Israel Project, to destabilize any Arab regime which might have any kind of autonomy and self-determination. Any regime in the Arab world that is not an absolute puppet cannot be tolerated. And who are the nations that we target? Those that are not puppets. We don't target those like the Saudi regime, which is the biggest human rights violator in that region. It's cutting off people's heads in public, cutting off hands. It is the most grotesque regime on the planet, and yet we give that regime weapons, and it's no problem whatsoever. The duplicity and hypocrisy of the United States and the West can't even be measured. It is so enormous. And these mouthpieces, such as this gentleman in Washington, is only doing a disservice to himself and his country. And the fact is that American sons and daughters will get involved in this yet again, and these chicken hawks who are pretending to care about the Syrian people are going to be sacrificing not their own sons and daughters. I would like this man to send his sons and daughters and his grandchildren off to Syria when this turns into a greater conflict, because this is what we're flirting with, is a world war, a third world war. This is not a joke. We are flirting with a third world war on the basis that apparently we care so much about the Syrian people, just like we care so much about the Iraqi people and the Afghani people. The only people that buy this sort of stuff are either bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb. And we're also led to believe that Assad is the dumbest idiot dictator on the planet now, isn't he? Because he invited UN inspectors to come in, and he brought them in on the very day that they come in. He decides to attack his own people 10 miles away from where the inspectors arrive. This is beyond ridiculous. And the only people that buy this, again, are bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb.
The Greater Israel Plan was actually pre-planned by Theodore Herzl long before, when he said, the area of the Jewish state stretches from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates.
but they did not learn what went on in World War II. The perpetrators, the victorious Allies and their Jewish handlers, they hid the crimes from the world with a blitz of books, TV programs, documentaries, and movies, as you point out. And to this day, look around just. Look around ourselves. We have wars in the Middle East nonstop for the sake of Israel and Israel alone. Now, Israel has a proxy called the United States. Let's just call him Uncle Stupid or Uncle Sucker. Every time Israel wants an enemy taken out, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, or hopefully not Iran, they want us to attack Iran. Well, they just point their pit bull, Uncle Stupid, in that direction, and Uncle Stupid dutifully goes to war with that nation and destroys it. That has got to stop. We didn't learn from World War II, and we're still committing the same mistakes.
Being a dreadful, awful, ghastly racist such as myself does tend to give me an advantage, because it means I can actually talk about race. And we do need to talk about race, because the 21st century, unless things change, will see the virtual extinction of my white European race.
Back in Europe, and by extension, America, Canada, and Australia, the indigenous people, cultures, and nations have now lost their right to exist in their own homelands and are now facing extinction. In fact, today it is basically a crime for an area to be too white. No school, no town, no nation is allowed to be white anymore. Yet, there are no one pushing for Israel, the Middle East, Africa, or Asia to become multicultural, right? The indigenous people of Europe are treated like second-class citizens in their own countries. The governments are actively working to lift up so-called minorities and push whites down. As an example of the utter hypocrisy, Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain have refused to take in refugees. So, have you seen any media footage about this? Have you seen anyone calling them racist? While white European women of childbearing age today are a small minority of 2% of the entire world's population, they are encouraged to breed outside of their own race, to throw away thousands of years of ethnic heritage and culture. The result will be that those pure genetics that have been refined in Europe for thousands of years will be gone forever.
So what is diversity? Is it this? Or is it this? According to the establishment, this is not diverse, but this? Very diverse. Not diverse? Very diverse. No diversity here? So diverse. We get it. The meaning of diversity as used by the establishment is everyone but white people. Well, unless they're sexual deviants. So it's everyone but straight, white people. Diversity is being rewritten to mean the inclusion of individuals representing more than one national origin, color, religion, socioeconomic group, sexual orientation. Did you get that? This definition says it's non-whites, Muslims, Jews, and anyone not Christian, poor people meaning the third world, and sexual deviants. According to them, if you don't include these groups, you will never qualify as diverse. So if you're a straight white person living in a homogenous, nationalist, Christian white country, you won't ever get a gold star for diversity. This new definition of diversity was inspired by Marxist critical theory, which arose from the Frankfurt School in the 30s. They were hostile communists who fled to America and pushed words like racism, xenophobia, anti-Semite to sow division. They pointed their fingers at others while they agreed with violent communist revolutions that killed more than any other ideology on the planet. You know what diversity doesn't include for a Marxist? Diversity of political opinions. Diversity can only mean thinking like a leftist. They're not welcoming a wide range of political viewpoints. They're not saying it doesn't matter if you're a rightist because we accept you. No, they shout Nazi, racist, and demand censorship. They want to ruin your life and destroy you because of your differing political views. They don't want diversity of thought. They want leftist rule where dissenting opinions are shut down by force. diversity is used as a weapon against nationalists, and leftists use minority groups to further their agenda, to be the wedge that breaks apart the cohesion of the majority. We were told we must overcome our racist nature and embrace open borders for a more utopian world where we accept everyone, holding hands as one. We're told it's our duty as white people that we alone hold the key to usher in world peace. It's up to us to make our countries a home for everyone, where all races, religions, and ideologies live together in our country, because only white people are racist. Well, if you want to talk about peace, the most peaceful countries in the world happen to be white. When someone says, "You white people aren't diverse and can only become diverse by importing the third world into your countries," this is psychological warfare, an action intended to undermine our morale and unity as a people. An enemy can use pretty words while having dirty motives. Remember, communists talked about the greater good while they mass murdered millions of Russians who disagreed and stood in the way of their utopia. Migrant invaders in Europe learn very fast to shout racism and diversity because it gets them stuff. They don't care about sharing inequality. They want to be the king on the top.
Money! Money! Money!
The Europeans are the most compassionate and giving of any people. Third world nations receive billions in aid from us, and when they need medicine or education, who do they call? Us. But our goodwill is also easy to take advantage of. We get hustled. It's sad, but a white man can go to the moon, but just don't call him racist or he'll have a breakdown. That's how deep anti-white propaganda and lies has rotted our morale and confidence as a people. We don't even take our own side because it's practically the Holocaust if we do. In the beginning, leftists who pushed the dream of diversity were naive idealists, but not anymore. Despite terrorist attacks, increasing violence, rape, and constant conflict in our multicultural societies, we continue to be propagandized at every level that diversity is our strength. We're expected to deny reality. The truth is in our face, and the whites who live in diverse areas have to take the brunt of it. Rich white liberals who are activists for diversity live in their ivory towers, surrounded by other rich white people, chauffeured from white place to white place, untouched by all diversity. Harvard political scientist and leftist Robert Putnam sent out to do a study on how awesome diversity is. What did he really learn? When you shove a bunch of different people together, diversity, it creates less social cohesion, distrust, conflict, and it hurts overall civic life. People stop trusting each other, and they stop being nice and happy. Daily life becomes a battle. When you mix thousands of people together, from different cultures and languages, religions, social classes, and political views, they won't get along. What a shocking revelation. Diversity isn't like the TV shows where one of each race and creed goes shopping and lunches together, talking about how awesome liberalism is. Before the word diversity, white Americans were once whole as a united group in a country that was nearly entirely white. Even blacks did better during segregation versus today. It is diversity that has divided white people. We are now divergent. If there's a white neighborhood, company, government, or movie, we hear how it needs diversity. In other words, it needs non-whites. It is all about race, all about replacing white people wherever they are. We can't have anything that is all our own without hearing non-whites complain about it. They want us to facilitate them in everything we create, and they shout slavery, colonialism, Jim Crow, white supremacy to get a leg up because they couldn't do it on their own.
White people, give your fucking money, your fucking house, your fucking property. We need it fucking all. You need a reparation.
It's a strategy to win, and they didn't even come up with it on their own. Non-white minority groups have learned they can get ahead simply by crying diversity, even when they're not qualified for the position. It's a shakedown. Outgroups have learned they can align together, cry minority, and chisel their way into our spaces, weakening our cohesion as a group. It's a power grab. All the while, they pretend to care about the goodwill of all mankind through pretty words like equality and tolerance, diversity, but their actions say the opposite. They want their group to hold power and influence. They also want revenge and think white people owe them. But we don't. They don't care about the truth. They want to get ahead and they want to win as a group. It's not white people going to black or Asian areas demanding they include white people in every facet of their existence. They have things that are exclusively theirs, and they also have countries where they are the majority. They have no obligation to include anyone else, and neither do we. We whites should be a majority in our country. We made every aspect of it. There's nothing wrong with us being dominant in our own country. But even though we are still a majority, we're told it's supremacy when we occupy the majority of society. As white societies become increasingly diverse, there's no end in sight. And in cities where non-whites are the majority, they're calling for an end to white privilege, even though the job market openly discriminates against whites. And we hear how campuses must end racism, even when they are fully dictated by diversity politics. When will diversity finally be achieved? At what point will commies and non-whites be satisfied? I'll tell you. When Europeans no longer have an identity, culture, or country all their own. When white people no longer exist.
It's a kind of utopia. Just the fact that the whole world will mix up with each other, that in, I don't know, 70, 80 years, there will be no white people anymore, and only cappuccino-colored people.
Look, look, that's the only way. Wow. That's the only solution. This is my way of thinking.
Mix up.
It's our only hope. It's our way out of this.
Yes.
It's going to take some time, but it's really the only way. This sort of Singaporean model where everybody's so mixed up that you really don't know who to hate because everybody's so hopelessly intertwined, but we're a long way from that.
They're advocating the biggest genocide in all of history. I mean, once white is gone, it's gone. Mm-hmm. You ain't going to get it back, yeah. Right? Well, it's just interesting because this is only targeting whites. They're not talking about no more brown people or no more black people, just no more white people, because then that will solve the problem. If we're all just darker skinned, then we won't hate each other.
This is the solution to the problem. Cappuccino colored. You know,
that's
Germans.
Right. They started talking about Cologne and all the rapes, and then it goes into the final solution. The only solution is for those women to have brown babies. Are you fucking kidding me? I think that we should go down there and tell them that Jews and Palestinians should blend for peace, right?
Yeah, of course.
You need to just end this by mixing yourself out and have mixed babies, and then maybe the conflict will end.
Exactly.
Well, there's another coincidence, though, and you brought this out, the changing face of America. Do you remember that? Pushing all this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Lisa Funderburg, who turns out is Jewish. You know, remember these pictures of these very unrealistic babies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The dream the mocha-colored future of all of us. Israel has a huge wall around its country.
There will be no white people anymore.
Let's take a look at Israel in the meantime, right?
Okay, fine. I get that. It's not a problem. You don't want these people in your countries. I get that. But then don't come and judge us for not wanting it and push it into our countries. That's the problem I have with here. Israel recognizes less than 1% of asylum seekers. I mean, talk about the utter hypocrisy.
They even have DNA issues in terms of immigration, right? That you have to have for you to get in to Israel, you have to be Jewish by DNA.
That right? is correct.
And it's actually worse. It's worse than that, because what they're doing now is that they're actually shipping people out of Israel to send them to places like Sweden, right? So they actually pay specifically African migrants, because Jews, many Jews in Israel, they actually hate blacks. They have a huge problem with racism in Israel. But they're going to the shores of Europe to welcome Syrian migrants, African migrants, Afghani migrants, Iraqi migrants, pointing the way, standing out and like waving, you know, here it is, coming this way, right?
Yeah, literally doing that. Again, you have Jewish women showing up in Europe in a country that is not theirs, that are welcoming invaders. Let's go to Israel. I said this on Twitter. Let's get a good group together, go to Israel, start up some aid, you know, and then welcome. Just welcome all the non-Jews, the Arabs, the Africans. Why can't we do that? What would happen then? How about we go there and set up aid for the Palestinians? And why aren't these women doing that if they claim that, oh, we're in such a good relationship with Muslims?
If we would have gone to Israel and done something like this, there would be military descending on us in 10 minutes. Yeah. We probably wouldn't even make it there, to be honest, of invading their space, right? Again, without people realizing, it's actually a huge strategy behind this to bring in more migrants into Europe to destroy them ethnically, right?
They're against everything white and pro-minority up and down. They're pro-gun control, always pro-gun control. They're always pro-minority. They're always pro-illegal immigration. They're always pro-Middle Eastern war and American body bags. They're always anti-white. Jews are always foremost in promoting race mixing among whites and browns and blacks. You can see it in American TV as far back as 20 and 30, 40 years even.
And on top of this actual phenomenon that we can all witness, we have the propaganda.
Every ad I see now has some kind of mixed couple of some sort. I see this being pushed everywhere. White men are made to look nerdy and stupid. They can't dance and they're so boring. But the non-white men are made to look strong, masculine, and heroic. It is no longer a good thing to have white children. They are considered boring and undiverse.
Not only do you have propaganda, which is massively anti-white, we have weaponized words. Anyone that talks about any of these topics is always called one particular word. And can you guess what that word is?
The R word.
Racist. Anytime you have propaganda and weaponized words, especially words that are supposed to set off triggers to shut you down, to keep you shut up. And we have phenomenon. We're no longer in the realm of propaganda. If you have propaganda backed up by phenomenon, we're now into warfare, psychological warfare.
Yep.
And psychological warfare is always reduced down to, you know, you're either with us or against us. You have to have something to say when people are calling you a name, especially in a mean, malicious way. And the word racist is used as a weapon all over Western civilization. It's used to stigmatize. It's used basically to silence any opposition. And what you want to do is not be silent. So when someone calls you a racist, you just say, you're just saying it because I'm white. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. Racism only applies to white people's homes, white people's churches, white countries. It doesn't apply to anyone else. They're not trying to yell racism anywhere else. Racism is an anti-white hate slur, is really what it is. And the phenomenon in Western civilization is massive amounts of immigration. You can't debate it. You can't even talk about it. Or you're a Nazi. We've all heard the words before. So we have forced immigration, forced integration, forced assimilation. And then they tell us, about our inevitable brown future.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing this in white countries and only white countries. You know, China is still going to be Chinese 50 years from now. Africa is still going to be Africa. Saudi Arabia is still going to be full of Arabs. But we're all supposed to be blended.
United Nations data show that the African population is rising from 200 million in 1950 to a projected 4.2 billion in 2100. This is an increase of 2,000%. These projections foresee 40% of the world's population and about half of its children being African by the end of this century. The world has right now more than 60 million people that would want to get to the West. Relocating these people geographically to every white country will not help anybody, and our nations, people, and cultures will never survive it.
Some people say that mass immigration into the United States can help reduce world poverty. Is that true? Well, no, it's not. And let me show you why. This gumball represents the 1 million legal immigrants that the United States has taken every year on average since 1990. Now, who in the world deserves our humanitarian compassion? The World Bank has one measure of the desperately poor of the world. They make less than $2 a day. How many people make less than $2 a day in the world? Well, let's start with Africa. In Africa alone, there are 650 million people who make less than $2 a day. 650 million. And in India, another 890 million people, desperately poor. China adds another 480 million people making less than $2 a day. And unfortunately, the rest of Asia has a heartbreaking 810 million people who the World Bank says make less than $2 a day. And finally, there's 105 million of Latin America's population that are desperately poor. All told, the World Bank says there are 3 billion people in the world, 3 billion people who are desperately poor, making less than $2 a day. That's 3,000 gumballs. And every year, we take a million and suggest that we've somehow made a humanitarian difference. Of course, we don't pull our immigrants from these desperately poor populations, do we? These people are too poor, too sick, too disconnected to make it here as immigrants. We tend to pull our immigrants out of the better off poor of the world. How many people in the world live in countries that have average incomes lower than that of Mexico? And the World Bank tells us that that number is these 3 billion plus another 2.6 billion people. 5.6 billion people in the world who live in countries with average incomes below that of Mexico. That's 5,600 gumballs. And so what is it that the elites are telling us? They're telling us that when we take this 1 million immigrants, that we somehow or another are tackling world poverty. And we have to do it regardless of the effect on our unemployed, the working poor, the most vulnerable members of our society, regardless of the effect on our natural resources. Even if we went by the most radical proposals in Washington, which are to actually double our immigration to 2 million a year, which would totally overwhelm our physical, natural, and social infrastructures, we couldn't make a noticeable difference. And we may be really hurting the impoverished people of the world, because the million that we do take are among the most energetic, often the better educated, certainly the most dissatisfied people that, if they did not immigrate, would be the agents for change to improve the lot of all the people in these countries. The true heroes in the global humanitarian field are the people in these countries who have the wherewithal to immigrate to another country, but instead stay in their countries to apply their skills to help their fellow countrymen. Unfortunately, our immigration system tends to entice these very type of people to abandon their countrymen. The impossibility of making even a dent is actually worse than it looks here, because last year, when we took 1 million immigrants, these countries added, births over deaths, 80 million more people into the impoverished population. And this year, Congress is bringing in 1 million legal immigrants. And this year, according to the United Nations, these countries are expected to add another 80 million people. And next year, you can be quite sure that Congress, unless stopped by the American voters, will bring in another 1 million immigrants. And these countries, unfortunately, will be adding another 80 million people into these impoverished nations. We could take 5 million a year, but we'd never get ahead of what's happening in these countries. Not in this century. Don't you see? Immigration can never be an effective or significant way to deal with the suffering people of the world. They have to be helped where they live. 99.9% of them will never be able to immigrate to a rich country. There's no hope for that. They have to bloom where they're planted. The only place that 99.9% of these people can be helped is where they live. Let's help them there.
What is happening today is the replacement of the white race, which the UN even admits to and calls replacement migration. This is, in fact, according to the UN's definition, a genocide, white genocide. Massive non-white immigration to all European white countries is textbook genocide. Genocide is simply the intentional attempt to get rid of an ethnic group or destroy its foundations of life, which is exactly what is happening to white Europeans in the world, as millions of hostile third world migrants are flooding their countries, changing their demographics rapidly. At the very same time, our establishment is promoting abortion, divorce, feminism, hookup culture, miscegenation, and homosexuality to lower the birth rates of the white Europeans. After the fall of the Third Reich, genocidal Kaufmann, Kudenhof Kalergi, and the Hutten plans for Germany became the reality for all of Western Europe through the creation of the European Union and the UN. Not only Germany, but the entire white Western world has since then undergone attacks of unprecedented scales demographically that will lead to the indigenous European populations very soon becoming minorities in the homelands of their own ancestors.
Figures compiled for the program suggest that in the next 20 years, the ethnic diversity of this city will change dramatically.
For the first time ever, the number of people who class themselves as white British is now a minority in London.
People who identify as white British citizens are now a minority in their capital cities.
White folks are on track to becoming, and I hate to say this, the minority in America.
A new report out by the government shows that by the year 2042, white Americans will no longer represent the majority of the population. That prediction is 8 years sooner than previously expected.
That the native French population would be finding itself in a rapidly decreasing minority.
Her kan etnisk norske være i mindretall om 20 år I 2030.
Children from white families in Birmingham are set to become a minority group for the first time when this year's census is collected in March.
The latest census suggests white British born are now in a minority.
Census Bureau says white will be a minority.
Californians know a thing or two about demographic change. 70% of all state school pupils in Los Angeles are Hispanic.
For the first time in American history, non-whites will make up half or more of the next generation, according to a new study by the Pew Research Center.
The latest census suggests that white Brits are now in a minority in London.
And the fact that we are going to become a minority in our own country before 2050, well before 2050 for the younger people.
When the parent culture kind of dissipates, you're left thinking, well, what's going on?
At the end of days, you're going to need the iron of Esav, which represents Edom, which is the West, Europe, and the Americas, to get intermixed with Yishmael, which is basically Arabs and Muslims. How in the world was this ever going to happen if not for this refugee crisis? At the end of days, you're going to have this intermixing between Esav, Edom, which is the West, and the East, which is the Muslims and the Arabs, making this through this influx into the world. And they're going to have children, you know, I don't want to say by the dozens, but they're going to have a far larger birth rate than the indigenous people there, and they're going to sort of conquer by number. And there are many different sources for this, one of them in Yehezkel, chapter 14, and many other sources as far as this is concerned, where it's mentioned very, very vividly what will happen to the Jews and what will happen to Yerushalayim and what will happen to the world at that time, where there will be many, many people killed and so on and so forth. So the idea of having these refugees come into Europe, it's no longer a matter of whether it's right or wrong, it's just simply fulfillment of what it was meant to be all along. This is the fulfillment of the Divrei Chazal and the prophecies. This has to happen, and this is just another sign that we are nearing, you know, the completion of the tikkun of the entire world.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country. To make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here. The 12 million that, or 13 million that just live here and do work and aren't really going home, that they have a chance to stay here justly and with as legal immigrants.
Now, coming back to your question of the clash between the secular post-Christian Europe and the new immigration wave, which is essentially religious, yes, this is exactly what is happening. There is a clash of civilizations. And we, the Jews, we are in the middle of this clash of civilizations.
I've always believed that Britain is a country of migrants. I'm Jewish.
The Jews want us dead because we have been their greatest challenge ever since they started their program of basically dividing and conquering.
Meine Damen und Herren, ich rufe Sie auf an der Demonstration Schöner Leben ohne Nazis, Vielfalt ist unsere Zukunft am 6. Juni in Neuruppin um 10 Uhr teilzunehmen. Wir müssen uns gegen die Nazis stellen. Schon aufgrund unserer Geschichte zwischen 1933 und 1945 sind wir verpflichtet, Flüchtlinge anständig zu behandeln. Außerdem muss deren Leben gerettet werden im Mittelmeer. Und es muss einen legalen Weg geben, um in Europa Asyl zu beantragen. Auch Länder wie Polen, sehr katholisch übrigens, müssen bereit sein, Flüchtlinge aufzunehmen. Dann gibt es ja noch was. Jedes Jahr sterben mehr Deutsche, als geboren werden. Das liegt zum Glück daran, dass die Nazis sich auch nicht besonders vervielfältigen. Und schon deshalb sind wir auf Zuwanderer aus anderen Ländern angewiesen.
AJC has always worked on the premise that as a minority, our security, our strength, our well-being in America is interdependent with those of other minorities. This is a Jewish issue.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real.
Immigration is the future. You cannot work and live in a globalized world, in the middle of the world, in Europe, without immigration and moving populations. So you have to really make a good policy of immigration all over Europe. And we see this, that the history of Europe, with this long history of nationalism and small countries, is now getting into a crisis. So this will need a long time to make it better. But you have to confront this. You have to really change the policy of immigration inside Europe. This is very important. You have to adapt the educational system and adapt all the all the self-understanding of the states. They are not anymore only white or only Swedish or only Portuguese or only German. They are multicultural places in the world.
Le Mashiach viendra que quand Edom, l'Europe, la chrétienté sera totalement tombée. Donc je vous pose la question, c'est une bonne nouvelle que l'islam envahisse l'Europe? C'est une excellente nouvelle, ça annonce l'avenir du Mashiach. Excellente nouvelle.
The liberal democrats will always stand up for a Britain that is open, tolerant and diverse. And in that spirit, I very much welcome the Jewish European Election Manifesto, calling for a strengthening of EU hate crime legislation. As a party, we wholeheartedly value the relationship we have with the Jewish community, both in Britain and internationally.
We see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers, and they are our natural allies.
4 million Africans, 5 million Filipinos, 2-3 million Sinim, and peace on Israel. Why is it important that there are 4
million Africans?
It's important because there will not be a Jewish country. It's different from other countries. Our country is a Jewish country, a Jewish country, and a democracy.
So how many people in Europe would be eligible under the law of return to move here?
3 million, 4 million maybe altogether. It could change the geopolitics.
What do you mean that it could change the geopolitics?
You know, it's the demography is the key of everything, as you know. Between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, this is the borders, 10 million people, about 500,000 Jews and 500,000 Arabs. And if we want to remain a democratic state, we have to have a majority of Jews in this place.
Europe is not always going to be there, I'm afraid. 2025 in Europe will be very different to 2015, and 2035 will be different to 2025 ad infinitum. And this is purely down to demographics. You know, the English have taken on board the preaching of the feminist groups, and we no longer have enough children. And we're now down to 1.5 child per couple, which means tomorrow's generation is 25% smaller than today's generation. But the Islamic immigrants coming in are averaging 4 children per couple. And that's not just per couple, because they also have 4 wives. Not all of them, but some of them. So some of them are having 16 children per one man. And furthermore, when the average English woman, if she can be bothered to have a child at all, is in her mid-30s or early 40s, these Muslim women are having children aged 16 to 21. We are really going to start to notice the rise, not just in demographics, but as they grow, they start demanding more and they start pushing more. And because they back this up with terrorism and with jihad, the government listens to them. You know, they push, we submit. And that's what's happening in Britain, and of course with Lars in Denmark, and all across Europe. Sweden is literally a lost country. You know, we in Britain have maybe 2 decades before everything really hits the wall. In Sweden, we're looking at 5 years to 10 years, and Sweden has terrible, enormous problems. Malmö is now the rape capital of the European continent. Aside from South Africa, I think it's the rape capital of the world. It is that bad. By the time the politicians have finally got the balls to stand up and tell the truth, it may be too late at that time from demographic reasons to actually do anything about it. Now, I came here really today to make the point that do not let what has happened in Europe and in Britain happen to America. You all need to look at what's happening in Britain and Sweden and Europe, and you all need to make sure that you retain your First Amendment rights, because unless we can talk about this, unless we can bring it out in the open, you in America will go the same way. You need to stand up and look at what we're doing and say, this is never going to happen here. Thank you.
A lot of the Jews that I've talked to seem to be very pro-immigration, but not to Israel. Like, do you think that Israel should be taking a lot of Syrian refugees in?
It's probably not in their self-interest.
That's not what I asked.
Man, that's hard.
not really.
Probably, I mean...
Yes or no?
Probably not.
Why?
Because they sort of want to kill the people that they would immigrate to.
my concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. If you abolish slavery, you abolish slaveholders. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate, not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. I could not point to any examples where it has provoked political censorship. To me, whiteness is an identity that arises entirely out of oppression. Whiteness is not a culture. It's not a religion, it's not a language, it's simply an oppressive social category. Blackness is an identity that can be plausibly argued to arise out of a resistance to oppression. Black studies is the study of a people that has formed itself in resistance to its oppression. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Europe must be multicultural. Jews are going to be at the center of that.
Drastic number of refugees by the end of 2015, believed to be in the region of 1.5 million.
It is not quite on a biblical scale, but an exodus it certainly is. Migrants who've been trapped at the railway station in Budapest, now deciding to walk the hundreds of miles to Germany and what they see as the promised land.
The other side of this tragedy is how it will change Europe. Non-Western migrants had already been flooding into Europe for decades. Leaders refuse to stop it.
We are afraid. We are in danger every day, every minute. They're coming inside, the police. They want to kill each other. And you have to do something. Someone has to protect us. They are in our house. We are the victims. We are not them. We have to live like before. We have to live our life. They took it for us. We're not in war. They are. We have to take them from here. It's a city.
ولكنهم فقدوا إخصابهم ويبحثون عن إخصاب عندنا ننجب منهم لأننا سوف نفتح بلادهم خذوا اللاجئين سنطلبهم منكم قريبا
Ganz ehrlich, der Islam wird in Deutschland kommen, ob du willst oder nicht. Deine Tochter wird Kopftuch tragen. Sein Sohn wird Bart tragen. Okay? Und deine Tochter wird einen Bärtigen heiraten. So, und wir vermehren uns immer mehr. Ihr Deutschen kriegt ja keine Kinder. Ihr kriegt höchstens, wenn es hochkommt, 2 Kinder. Wir machen 7, 8. Alhamdulillah. Okay, Kollege? Und dann nehmen wir uns auch nochmal 4 Frauen, dann haben wir 22 Kinder. So, ihr habt vielleicht ein Kind und ein Hündchen. Ne? Und das war's. Kollege, das ist nicht unsere Schuld, das ist eure Schuld. Wenn ihr unsere Länder ausgebeutet habt, kolonisiert habt, damit du einen Mercedes fahren kannst und deine Digitalkamera da benutzen kannst, so macht Allah Azza wa Jalla, der allmächtige Gott, macht das so, dass wir euch erobern, nicht mit Krieg hier in Deutschland, sondern mit Geburtenraten, erstens. Und zweitens, wir heiraten eure Töchter. Und deine Tochter wird Kopftuch tragen. So, jetzt kannst du richtig einmal durchdrehen. Man sieht schon richtig den Hass in deinen Augen.
Thank you.
father of the European Union, Richard Kudinov Kalergi, published the plan for a united Europe and the ethnocide of the peoples of Europe. The encouragement of non-white immigration was central to the plot. Since then, an unholy alliance of leftists, capitalists, and Zionist supremacists has schemed to promote immigration and miscegenation with the deliberate aim of breeding us out of existence in our own homelands. As indigenous resistance to this human genetic modification industry grows, the criminal elite seeks new ways to camouflage their project. First, their immigrant pawns were temporary guest workers. Then it was a multiracial experiment. Then they were refugees. Then the answer to a shrinking population. Different excuses, different lies. And asylum is just another one. But the real aim stays the same. The biggest genocide in human history. The final solution of the Christian European problem. This crime demands a new set of Nuremberg trials, and you people will be in the dock.
Mr. President, I'm really ashamed of the racist and xenophobic terms that were used by Mr. Griffin. And my only question to him is if he dared to make any concrete suggestions and amendments to the legislation. Is your policy serious, or are you just shouting? And I hope you will not be re-elected if you seek re-election, because it's a shame for this parliament, the kind of statements you have just made.
It's you that's shouting, because obviously the truth hurts. Yes, I will be seeking re-election. Yes, I hope to return here to speak up for the indigenous Europeans, which the founder of this place has deliberately set out to wipe out, because that is a crime. I'm telling the truth. I have a constructive suggestion to help those poor asylum seekers from Africa. Yes, make it clear they can't come here, so they don't try to cross the sea and drown in huge numbers. The best way for them is to get the banks off the backs of their countries so they can live in peace in their countries, and we Europeans can live in peace in ours.
Tell en oplevelse til mig og min muskel, hun har haft os her til eftermiddag. Vi var ude og gå, som vi sjovt nok altid plejer at gøre. Og så skulle vi ned til den store sø, fordi at det er altså godt vejr. Og vi skal ud og lege, og Carsten skal have lov til at lege søen. Der sker så det, at der kommer fire gutter hen, og først spørger ind til min hund. Hvor er efterfølgende, at de begynder at sparke ud efter ham. Hvilket jeg bliver rigtig, rigtig, rigtig tosset over. Og vi kommer op og diskuterer. Og så sker der det, at de begynder at kaste sten efter os. Jeg kan sgu ikke helt præcis huske, hvad der så ellers skete, men lige pludselig så står de flere mennesker og river fat i mig. Som I kan se. Jeg ved ikke, om man kan se det. Men jeg har begyndt bare at smadre mig ned i jorden. Og begyndt at sparke til mig. Og rulle mig rundt. Og så kaste de mig ud i søen. Så nu står jeg her drivvåd. Med en hund, der skal styre den. Fordi han er skide bange. Og han bliver ramt med en sten. Og jeg synes, simpelthen er for dårligt, at man skal sådan noget her igennem, bare fordi man har en hund, som folk ikke kan lide. Hvis I ikke kan lide min hund, så lad være med at komme ind til os.
Nej, vi har alle keine Lust, vi har alle Angst.
Wir denken vor 100 Jahren. Es ist trotzdem nicht mal.
Da kann man mal sehen, wie viele wir hier schon drin haben von diesen Leuten. Und jetzt sind wir einfach so viele hier dazugekommen. Jedes Jahr kommen 2-3 Millionen.
Es geht allgemein über die
Verfremdung.
Ja. Wir werden nicht mehr so rumlaufen.
Hier. Ich lasse mir nichts wegnehmen. Ich lasse mir nichts wegnehmen.
Aber schau, ich bin auch hier. Ich habe mich bewegt hier in der Straße. Was für Spaß.
Ja.
Wir gehen zu den Schwarzen.
Ja.
Einfach nicht. Frauen an.
Alles verschleiert. Alles.
Wie wir schaffen das sind gemeinsam den Untergang.
Ja, nein.
increasing groups of people who are essentially asking the question, if the political establishment continues to get its way, in 5, in 10, in 20 years' time, how many Germans are going to be left in Germany? How many French people are going to be left in France? How many English people are going to be left in England?
French writer Renaud Camus calls the influx the Great Replacement and says it's the biggest thing to happen to France since the 15th century.
Quel est l'objectif? Ça va faire parler. Mais l'objectif, c'est relever le défi du métissage. Ce n'est pas un choix. C'est une obligation. Si ce volontarisme républicain ne fonctionnait pas, il faudra alors que la République passe à des méthodes plus contraignantes encore. Nous devons changer, alors nous allons changer.
Hardly anyone imagined just 20 years ago that the native French population would be finding itself in a rapidly decreasing minority here.
London has got so ethnically diverse that white Britons are now a minority here.
White families in Birmingham are set to become a minority group for the first time.
The country's most rapidly growing demographic is Muslim.
With Mohammed now the most popular name for baby boys in London.
The high Muslim birth rate is changing the political landscape. Imran is looking forward to replacing Belgian law with Sharia law, including amputation for theft, stoning for adultery, and death to homosexuals.
If they want to push us back or something like that, I don't know, maybe they can start to marry 4 wives and have a lot of children. Start with that, maybe they will have a chance, but I don't think so.
Something else that Muslim immigration appears to have brought to Norway is what some here call a rape epidemic. Recent police statistics showed that in the capital of Oslo, 100% of assault rapes between strangers were committed by immigrant non-Western males, and 9 out of 10 of their victims were native Norwegian women.
They're taking this gay pride march through a predominantly Muslim neighborhood here in Stockholm. And there are fears that it could stoke tensions between some of the local residents and the people demonstrating here.
What's the provocation?
It's a provocation against the Muslim population.
Basically, the U.S. is providing these flows for us. You make war and we get the refugees.
The United Nations report says Sweden will be a third world nation in about 15 years, below Libya and Bulgaria.
بل إن إخواننا ضحوا أموالهم وحتى أرواحهم فداء لهدف الوحيد. But there is no other path to victory except through sacrifice and jihad for the sake of Allah.
Swedes who disagree with that plan risk being labeled racist, fascist, even Nazi.
This footage of the Revolutionary Front smashing the home of a suspected fascist.
We're not even talking France, we're not even talking Germany, we're not even talking Belgium, or any of the other countries in the EU. In the UK alone, we have 23,000 known jihadis. 23,000. That is larger than some portions of our military. We basically have a foreign military in our lands as a consequence of this immigration policy. And our politicians continue to welcome tens of millions of Muslims into our country. Our politicians are directly endangering the citizens of our countries. At the very least, this is extreme negligence. At worst, this is pure treason. We cannot stand for this. We cannot let this happen. We need to close our borders. We need to have the military on our borders, guarding our borders now.
Yes, but you also have a declining birth rate, and you need, for a flourishing economy, you need some growth. And it has to be replaced by migrants from outside.
I believe in breaking down borders. I believe in European integration. I was part of the 1992 process that removed borders.
Unsere Gesellschaft wird sich ändern. Unsere Stadt wird sich radikal verändern. Ich bin der Auffassung, dass wir in 20, 30 Jahren gar keine ethnischen Mehrheiten mehr haben in unserer Stadt. Und ich sage Ihnen noch ganz deutlich, gerade hier in Richtung rechts, das ist gut so.
Auf der Heide blüht ein kleines Blümelein und das heißt Erika und dein Herz ist voller Süßigkeit. Zarter Duft entströmt dein Blütenkleid. Auf der Heide blüht ein kleines Blümelein und das heißt Erika.
Goyim are mentally inferior to Jews and can't run their nations properly. For their sake and ours, we need to abolish their governments and replace them with a single government. This will take a long time and involve much bloodshed, but it's for a good cause. Here's what we'll need to do. Place our agents and helpers everywhere. Take control of the media and use it in propaganda for our plans. Start fights between different races, classes, and religions. Use bribery, threats, and blackmail to get our way. Use Freemasonic lodges to attract potential public officials. Appeal to successful people's egos. Appoint puppet leaders who can be controlled by blackmail. Replace royal rule with socialist rule, then communism, then despotism. Abolish all rights and freedoms except the right by force by us. Sacrifice people, including Jews sometimes, when necessary. Eliminate religion. Replace it with science and materialism. Control the education system to spread deception and destroy intellect. Rewrite history to our benefit. Create entertaining distractions. Corrupt minds with filth and perversion. Encourage people to spy on one another. Keep the masses in poverty and perpetual labor. Take possession of all true wealth, property, and especially gold. Use gold to manipulate the markets, causing depressions, etc. Introduce a progressive tax on wealth. Replace sound investment with speculation. Make long-term interest-bearing loans to governments. Give bad advice to governments and everyone else. Eventually, the Goyim will be so angry with their governments, because we'll blame them for the resulting mess, that they'll gladly have us take over. We will then appoint a descendant of David to be the king of the world, and the remaining Goyim will bow down and sing his praises. Everyone will live in peace and obedient order under his glorious rule.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money, and the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay, they are talented people and they have power, money and media and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic, and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
Through the implementation of the Federal Reserve System, the government has become vested in these bankers, and they get their money from the bankers. And so then they impose a tax on us, which makes us more slaves, makes it more difficult for us to survive, right? Giving them more profits. And now what's happened is that through the Federal Reserve System, the bankers have pretty much taken control of our government. It doesn't matter Republican and Democrat anymore, because they're both the same. Neither one of them are talking about shutting down the Federal Reserve System or stopping the payment of taxes, you know, or any of the big issues that face Americans, right? So I had a friend, Nick Rockefeller, okay, who was one of the Rockefeller family, and he, when I was running for governor in Nevada, he came to me, introduced himself to me through an attorney, and we became friends. We started talking about things, and I learned an awful lot from Mr. Rockefeller. And one of the things that we used to talk about was the ultimate plan of the banking industry, what they wanted to accomplish. And the goals of the banking industry, not just the Federal Reserve System, but the private banks in Germany and England, all over Italy, all over the world, they all work together. They're all central banks, and they're all part of the Communist Manifesto. You know, central banking is one of the major planks of the Communist Manifesto. We talk about America being a capitalistic country, but yet at the same time we have a central bank that plans everything for us, right? And the graduated income tax is another plank of the Communist Manifesto, right? So right there you have two major planks of the Communist Manifesto that have been brought in because of the Federal Reserve System, okay? So the ultimate goal that these people have in mind is the goal to create a one-world government run by the banking industry, run by the bankers, and they're doing it in sections. The European currency, the euro, and the European Constitution is one part of it. Now they're trying to do it in America with the North American Union, right? And they want to create a new currency called the Amero, right? And the whole agenda is to create a one-world government where everybody has an RFID chip implanted in them. All money is to be in those chips, right? There'll be no more cash. And this is giving me straight from Rockefeller himself. This is what they want to accomplish. And all money will be in your chips. And so instead of having cash, anytime you have money in your chip, they can take out whatever they want to take out whenever they want to. If they say you owe us this much money in taxes, they just deduct it out of your chip digitally.
Total control.
And if you're like me or you, and you're protesting what they're doing, they can just turn off your chip. And you have nothing. You can't buy food. You can't do anything. It's total control of the people.
And that chip's connected to a database that has your purchasing records, what you do.
Everything. Everything is in there, you know? And so they want a one-world government controlled by them, everybody being chipped, all your money in those chips, and they control the chips, and they control people, and you become a slave, you become a serf to these people. That's their goal, that's their intention.
All of what we can see happening in the world is part of greater plans called the Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, and Vision 2050. These are the United Nations plans to depopulate the planet from 7.5 billion down to 500 million and then rule humanity under a communist one world government in the year 2030. This is what the globalists want. A world government will give the globalists absolute control over all of the world's resources and population.
Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge. And today that new world is struggling to be born. A world quite different from the one we've known. A world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle.
The opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order. A world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind.
And that's why I wanted to speak to you today about the new world taking shape around us, about the prospects for a new world order now within our reach. In the coming weeks, I'll be talking in some detail about the possibility of a new world order emerging after the Cold War. But today, I want to discuss another aspect of that order. You see, as the Cold War drew to an end, we saw the possibilities of a new order in which nations work together. It refers to new ways of working with other nations to deter aggression and to achieve stability. As old threats recede, new threats emerge. The quest for the new world order is in part a challenge to keep the dangers of disorder at bay. We must build on the successes of Desert Storm to give new shape and momentum to this new world order. Only when this transformation is complete will we be able to take full measure of the opportunities presented by this new and evolving world order.
But it is the awareness itself that will drive the change. And one of the ways it will drive the change is through global governance and global agreements.
Now, much has been said by the Secretary of State and others about a new world order, about a defining moment in history. I have no doubt about the potential of this moment to be defining in terms of history. But that definition can be negative as well as positive. And how negative or positive it will be will depend on what kind of new world order we really create.
Never before has a new world order had to be assembled from so many different perceptions or on so global a scale.
The Great Seal of the United States. And that Great Seal of the United States has on it Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order for the centuries, for the ages, forever.
There is a chance for the President of the United States to use this disaster to carry out what his father, a phrase his father used, I think, only once and hasn't been used since, and that is a new world order.
During the conflict with Saddam Hussein, which he handled so superbly in a short-term sense, he kept talking about a new world order. And then President Bush, at the end of that war, promised he would give four graduation addresses, four commencement addresses, describing that new world order and what America's role was going to be in it. Turned out he gave one of those addresses and canceled the other to talk about something else. That's what, because they weren't.
And this present window of opportunity during which a truly peaceful
and interdependent world order might be built will not be here for open for too long.
It's past the point of talking. We know historically that the global governance agenda to these issues is very hard to try and is with all the best intentions, it's very hard to actually activate. We're seeing that right now. We're seeing a lot of fragmentation going on in Copenhagen, a lot of different agendas pulling in different directions.
These measures are enacted. We continue to move forward with the G20 process. We will have the kind of global governance that is necessary to ensure the stability and transparency of markets in a way that gives us the benefits of a globalized market economy without the enormous risks that...
There with my people, they were bombed, and I was just targeted like them, and as elected president, official in charge of their protection, I couldn't do anything about it. But the point here is, it's not about me, it's about the idea of freedom. It's about the future of the whole region. It's about the future of Europe and a new world order.
The Transatlantic Partnership was never just the foundation of our security. It was the foundation of our way of life. It was forged in experience of the most bitter and anguished kind. Out of it came a new Europe, a new world order, a new consensus as to how life should and could be lived. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us.
I think a new world order is emerging, and with it the foundations of a new and progressive era of international cooperation. We have resolved that from today, we will together manage the process of globalization to secure responsibility from all and fairness to all. And we've agreed that in doing so, we will build a more sustainable and more open and a fairer global society.
Realizes what I believe is our destiny of success in this new world order. So in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, a new world is emerging. It is a new world order with significantly different and radically new challenges.
Maybe some people dreamt of at that conference back in Bournemouth when it looked as if maybe history would end, that liberal democracy would triumph, that free market economics would slowly progress, and we'd have a new world order.
Tim, what do you think America's place in the new world order should be? It's always been seen as the global policeman. But as you said before, you know, it's hard to see with all these military conflicts where the winner and loser lies. What should America be doing globally?
I think the global policeman should be the United Nations.
What sort of a financial deal should Obama be seeking to strike when he travels to China next month?
No, I think this would be the time, because you really need to bring China into the creation of a new world order, financial world order.
What do you think the most important thing is for Barack Obama? Obviously, you're here to talk about the anniversary for U.S.-China diplomatic relations, but if you had to say this is going to be the country or the conflict or the place that will define the Obama administration, what would it be?
The president-elect is coming into office at a moment when there are upheavals in many parts of the world simultaneously. You have India, Pakistan, and you have the jihadist movement. So he can't really say that it's one problem, that it's the most important one. But he can give a new impetus to American foreign policy, partly because the reception of him is so extraordinary around the world. I think his task will be to develop an overall strategy for America in this period, when really a new world order can be created. It's a great opportunity. It isn't just a crisis. There's a need for a new world order, but it has different characteristics in different parts of the world.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order, because the global order is changing again. And the institutions and rules that worked so well in the post-World War II era for decades, they need to be strengthened.
So let's leave them something to think about as they go home. Let them go home and say, Mr. Soros said, here are three things we can do, simply. One?
Well, deal with the mortgage problem, reduce foreclosures, recapitalize the banks, and then work on a better world order, where we work together to resolve problems that confront humanity, like global warming.
At its core, Agenda 21 is about control. Control of the land, natural resources, and entire populations. It seeks to control the air by regulation of carbon emissions, the ground by sustainable development, and the sea through environmental regulations. Officially stated, Agenda 21 is a comprehensive plan of action to be taken globally, nationally, and locally by organizations of the United Nations system, governments, and major groups in every area in which human impacts on the environment. Because being human will always have an impact on the environment, Agenda 21 paves the way for extraordinary UN control. When you boil it down, there are 9 basic tenets of Agenda 21. Move citizens off private land and into urban housing. Create vast wilderness spaces inhabited by large carnivores. Eliminate cars and create walkable cities. Support chosen private businesses with public funds for sustainable development. Make policy decisions that favor the greater good over individuals. Drastically reduce the use of power, water, and anything else that creates carbon pollution. Use bureaucracies to make sweeping decisions outside of democratic processes. Increase taxes, fees, and regulations. And finally, implement policies meant to incentivize a reduced population.
The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
Controlling our every impact on the environment means controlling every aspect of our lives. What we eat, how we travel, where we live, how we live. But no is still an option.
Let me say one thing about choice. There is no real choice. They say freedom of choice. You're given an illusion of choice. Americans are meant to feel free by the exercise of meaningless choices.
And we will make America great again.
And when we do, America will be greater than ever.
But here in America, where there's supposed to be free choice, there's less choice. If Americans ever come to the conclusion that there's not much difference between Republicans and Democrats, and they never include alternative choices in the coverage, the Americans really aren't exposed to a true choice. So we really have to fight.
Former CIA operative, head of the Bin Laden tracking unit, Michael Schur. Michael, both the British and the United States have reportedly made it very clear to Israel they would prefer that there be no military action taken. What are your thoughts?
Well, we're at least in the United States, we're pretty helpless. If the Israelis attack Iran, the power of AIPAC and the lobby here, they own the Congress, will lead to our support for whatever the Israelis do, I think.
Well, every candidate for Congress at that time had a pledge. They were given a pledge to sign. And I was new on the scene. And so the pledge had Jerusalem as the capital city.
The eternal capital of the Jewish people, Jerusalem.
The military superiority of Israel.
American Congress people have to sign this pledge.
Yes, you sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money. So for example, it was almost like water torture for me. My parents observed this. I would get a call, and the person on the other end of the phone would say, I want to do a fundraiser for you. And then we would get into the planning. I would get really excited because, of course, you have to have money in order to run a campaign. And then 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the planning, they would say, did you sign the pledge? And then I would say, no, I didn't sign the pledge. And then my fundraiser would go kaput.
I'm saying this to you right now. Israel gets approximately $15 billion a year from the American taxpayers. That $15 billion
is $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. People in my district are losing their pension benefits. And I can't understand this, why no one in Congress is raising their voice. And the reason is very simple. This may be you don't want to hear, I don't know. And I certainly don't want to hurt you on your show. You have one of the best. You're fair. But I believe that Israel has a powerful stranglehold on the American government. They control both members of the House and the Senate. They have us involved in wars in which we have little or no interest. Our children are coming back in body bags. Our nation is bankrupt over these wars. And if you open your mouth, you get targeted. And if they don't beat you at the poll, they'll put you in prison. They're controlling much of our foreign policy. They're influencing much of our domestic policy. Wolfowitz, as Undersecretary of Defense, manipulated President Bush number two back into Iraq. They pushed definitely to try and get Bush before he left to move into Iran. We're conducting an expansionist policy of Israel, and everybody's afraid to say it. They control much of the media. They control much of the commerce of the country. And they control powerfully both bodies of the Congress. They own the Congress.
Are you an anti-Semite?
No, I'm not. That's exactly what they're going to say. And I expect that. What I am is an American. You see, I think America comes first. And we have a one-sided foreign policy in the Mideast. And we've alienated Arabs who have no way of fighting. So what they've done, and I predicted this on the House floor, is they would export violence to America. And they have. They have no other way to fight. Greta, I'm saying this. America is in danger if America doesn't take back the government without foreign influence.
I went into the State Department Near East section and found there was not one single Palestinian, not one single Muslim, religious, Saudi, you know, Jordanian, not one Christian Protestant, not one Roman Catholic, not one plain old American, whatever, from Cornpone. Every single person in all of those offices were either Zionist, Israelis, whatever, and they had pictures all over the wall of Israel, Israel, Israel. They had magazines, Israel Today. You know, I was given a copy of one. And there were yarmulkes, you know, mm-hmm. and the Israeli writing. In other words, and I asked one of the women after having gone through about, you know, four or five of these offices, I said, because I was pretending like I really, you know, wanted, I was just kind of wanting to know where the Palestinian office was, you know. She said, well, we handle all of that. We handle all of that.
And this is the State Department, the
Near East, the part that handles Israel, Jordan, okay. All of these.
Egypt?
Yeah, yeah, the Near East section.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It was just totally dominated by
totally.
Israeli.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the spokesman, I can't remember his name, he was a Zionist, the spokesman for the whole State Department.
I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the Prime Minister of Israel, His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu.
The world has gone mad. There is no morals, there is no loyalty, there is no nothing. Everyone just do what you can, listen to the government, follow everybody like sheep, be brainwashed by all the Zionist Jewish people who own all the banks, all the papers, all the TV stations. Be brainwashed by all.
At a 1991 closed-door meeting of fellow internationalists, billionaire and former CFR chairman David Rockefeller praised his media allies. But his confidence that his words would not leave the room was later broken.
We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march toward a world government.
That these men aim to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In short, they seek total and quiet control of the entire world.
But we have to put our money where our mouths are. And we can only realize the promise of this institution's founding to replace the ravages of war with cooperation if powerful nations, like my own, accept constraints. Sometimes I'm criticized in my own country for professing a belief in international norms and multilateral institutions, but I am convinced that in the long run, giving up some freedom of action, not giving up our ability to protect ourselves or pursue our core interests, but binding ourselves to international rules over the long term enhances our security.
Out of all the groups, the most important one by a mile was the English Defence League, British Freedom Party. That was a serious, systematic, hugely funded effort by a section of the ruling elite, by this Zionist neocon clique, to dominate, to simply take over nationalism and turn it into their tool to encourage the white working class to go and fight their wars, and so that when the banking collapse comes, people are looking in the wrong direction instead of the real culprits. This party, we were approached. I was approached. We were offered money from the United States, and all they wanted was two things. They only wanted us to concentrate on Islam, and I yield to no one in my criticism of Islam and grooming. I put my neck on the line. Many of you have put your neck on the line as well. But it's not the only problem. And they wanted us only to focus on that, and it only came with one other thing. They wanted us to drop our criticism of the banking system. Those were the only two things. We had to concentrate on talking about Muslims, and we had to drop our criticism of the international banking system.
I believe, a quite terrifying masterpiece. So terrifying, in fact, I don't think I should like to read another like it.
I am not absolutely dissatisfied with it. I think it is a good idea, but the execution would have been better if I had not been under the influence of TB when I wrote it.
You once claimed that you have an ability to face unpleasant facts. Is that what you've demonstrated in 1984 by drawing an accurate portrait of the future?
I think that allowing for the book being, after all, a parody, something like 1984 could actually happen. This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. The sex instinct will be eradicated. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.